For the week of November 28th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 81, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
In Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Karen, you sound a little different today.
What do you mean?
Well, yeah, okay, so you probably know by now that that is actually Michael, who is filling in for Karen. Have no fear. The reason Karen is not here is because she's actually in Las Vegas at the International Association of Fairs and Expositions, where she is speaking about crisis communication in social media.
Well, I'm having a crisis communication right now because Karen isn't here. How can we do the podcast without Karen?
Well, you know, we do lead professional lives, and she's out there in Las Vegas telling them how Hollywood does it when there's a crisis in social media. And actually, we'll be talking a little bit about how Hollywood, or at least the music industry, is using Twitter a little later on in the podcast. And when we started putting notes together for today's show, we're recording on a Tuesday, a little later than usual because of the Thanksgiving holiday. I thought we're never going to be able to find anything. Hollywood kind of shuts down for Thanksgiving week, and blogs put up posts like the top 10 overeating scenes of all time. That was one of the lead posts on a blog I was reading. But we've got a ton of news, actually. We have some Hobbit, a bit of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The Lone Ranger, some Sesame Street shenanigans, a dash of Kanye West, a whole lot of fair use issues. And I know, Michael, you've been dying to talk about them. Stick around, and I promise you'll know all the important entertainment headlines from the past week, all of what we've discussed and more, including a few you may not have known about. Of course, we'll cover all the big news stories and big deal or big whoop. How we'll do that without Karen, I don't know. I'll have to fill in for her or something. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And it was a four-day weekend, so there's a lot to talk about.
That's right. And no surprise. Well, actually, a little bit of a surprise, a little bit of a cliffhanger. The number one movie at the box office was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, or HP7P1, as we like to call it. That grossed $50.3 million. It's grossed more than $600 million worldwide, but it just edged out Disney's new animated film Tangled, which was at number two at $49.1 million for the weekend and $69 million total in the U.S. and $83 million worldwide. So Disney's Tangled, which they perhaps did or didn't announce as being their last fairy tale animated film for a while, almost unseated Harry Potter. Not bad news for Harry Potter, though. The movie has grossed about $600 million worldwide already. It's clearly going to hit $900 million, just like the other six films in the series, if not be the first one to go past $1 billion. At number three at the box office was Megamind, which is really holding quite well. That's the animated film starring Will Ferrell. It grossed $12.8 million. It's at $130 million total in the U.S. At number four was Cher and Christina Aguilera's new movie Burlesque, which opened pretty good for a small indie film. It grossed $11.8 million over the weekend and about $18 million total. I'm not sure what the budget is, but it probably wasn't that big. And number five is Unstoppable, the Denzel Washington and Chris Pine action film, which grossed $11 million. It's at $60 million total, which is pretty good, but it did cost $100 million to make. At number six is the new Jake Gyllenhaal drama Love and Other Drugs, a romantic drama of sorts that grossed $9.8 million, $14 million total. At number seven, the biggest flop of the week, a Dwayne Johnson action film called Faster that grossed $8.7 million. I guess when you make a lot of family films, people don't take you seriously in action movies anymore. At number eight is Due Date, the Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis movie, and my nieces and nephews love Zach Galifianakis. It grossed $7.3 million and $85 million total. Then The Next 3 Days, which is really falling fast, that's the Russell Crowe film, that's at $14 million total. Morning Glory, the morning broadcast news type drama that we thought would catch on with adult audiences has not. That's at $26 million total. Slightly opening wider audiences are 127 Hours, the James Franco film, which has grossed $4.4 million total. It's doing okay, but not setting the world on fire. Same thing for Fair Game, the movie about Valerie Plame that stars Naomi Watts and Sean Penn, and that has grossed $6 million total. I saw Tangled this weekend, and I have to say, it was really cute. It's easily Disney's best film in a long time. What about you, Sterling? What did you see?
Well, actually, I saw Tangled for the umpteenth time as well. I've seen it several times now. I mean, it's in 3D, so that's one of the reasons I saw it long before it opened. But it's a really good film.
It is. It's. I love the animation for Maximus. Whoever was in charge of that character, that's a horse who sort of thinks he's a bloodhound of sorts. But it's a really great character. He doesn't talk, but he's very funny, very good. He's a really consistent good character. And whoever did that is probably going to end up directing some movies because he was great. But it's smart. It's good. It has some good songs, some Broadway-ish songs, some songs more Joni Mitchell, like they were saying they were trying for. And it's funny that as Disney says, oh, we know you're getting tired of the animated fairy tales, so we're going to back off from those. They deliver their best one in easily a decade, if not 15, 12 years. If you look at the list of Disney animated films in the 2000s, no wonder they said they were going to try something different. You've got The Princess and the Frog, Bolt, Meet the Robinsons, Chicken Little, Home on the Range, Brother Bear, Treasure Planet, Lilo and Stitch, Atlantis, The Lost Emperor, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, The Emperor's New Groove, Dinosaur, and Fantasia 2000. Now, they're not all based on fairy tales, obviously, but that is a decade-long run of underperforming, unexciting movies.
But wait a second, I'm gonna differ with you here. I believe The Emperor's New Groove, horrible title, but a pretty decent film.
No, Emperor's New Groove is decent, and Lilo and Stitch did well enough to get some direct-to-DVD releases. They're not all tremendous flops, but none of them make you say, oh my God, that's a new classic. The last great Disney movie was Tarzan, I think, in 1999.
That's the movie I was going to pick. I was trying to think, well, was it The Hunchback of Notre Dame? No, I think it was Tarzan.
Right. And before that, you've got a lot of movies that did well at the box office, but frankly had a lot of problems too. Were sort of okay, decent, pretty good, but not quite to their peak performance. And that includes Mulan, Hercules, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and Pocahontas.
You wouldn't include Aladdin in that?
No, Aladdin was a massive commercial hit and a massive critical success as well. Before that, you have The Lion King, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, and The Little Mermaid. That's their, their resurgence for what they
did
so well.
Let's go all the way back. I mean, they released 50 films. Tangled is their 50th animated motion picture.
That's right.
So why don't we just list them all? Black Cauldron, The Rescuers.
I'm just saying, when you go over the list of the last 15, 20 years, you go, wow, there are a lot of their animated films that did not work very well, despite the prestige of Disney. And as was pointed out last week by our guest, there was a 30-year gap between fairy tale animated movies. You had Sleeping Beauty in 1959, and then the next one was The Little Mermaid in 1989. So it's not unusual that Disney would take off 5, 10, 15 years between fairy tales. In fact, most of the movies in the 2000s are not fairy tale based whatsoever. But, Tangled is really good. They finally get back on top just as they say, hey, I don't know if we're going to keep doing this. Don't get bored by our fairy tales.
Right. I mean, it's a really good film, and I think people should definitely go see it.
Well, how was the 3D? I went to see it in 2D specifically. I said, you know what? I just don't want to pay the extra $5.
Really? Wow. Well, yeah. I'm surprised you were able to find a 2D screening. And secondly,
I was in Alabama.
The 3D was actually done quite well, and there is a sequence in the film, and I was interested to see how this sequence would play with children, because it plays off of the 3D, and there are all these lanterns, these lit up lanterns flying around, and it's a beautiful scene. In 3D, it's stunning, and I wanted to see how children would respond to it. Most of the time I've seen it, actually every time except the last time I've seen Tangled, it was with adults. So I wanted to see how children reacted, and they were reaching out with their hands. Almost the entire audience, all the children were reaching out. I thought it was very, very interesting.
Well, that is the showstopper scene in 3D, and it also is an emotional high point for the movie for a lot of reasons. You'll understand when you see the film, but it's not just 3D used in a flashy moment that's just sort of, oh, here's a chance to use 3D. It is really a very, very emotionally important point of the film, and so they use that 3D to spectacular effect in that scene that mattered so much emotionally, which is why it works even better than just being, a spear flying out at you. And in fact, that's the scene that my sister Leslie and my sister-in-law Deborah and Deborah's daughter Amanda, they went to see the movie, and that's the very scene they mentioned to me as being so stunning.
Well, you mentioned Unstoppable, the Denzel Washington film. I saw a Denzel Washington film over the weekend, and I was kind of catching up on a Hughes Brothers film called The Book of Eli.
Uh-huh.
Did you see this movie?
Yep.
It's a great film.
Talk to me.
I mean, you didn't think it was a good film?
I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was fun to see once. I have issues about the finale, which I actually have arguments about whether I even understand the finale, but we can't really discuss it because we'll give it away to people. But it's if you like sci-fi and dystopian and post-apocalyptic, it's a good solid movie to see once. If that's your thing, it is a good movie. It's fun to see. I don't think it's great like you, but it is good. It's solid. It's entertaining.
I have to say it was beautifully shot. If I was the cinematographer of that, Don Burgess, who is a very well-known cinematographer and has shot tons of award-winning films, I would be trying for an Academy Award for that film. It was really well done.
Was that this year? Or that was last year, wasn't it?
No, I believe it was released in January of this year. I don't know why they released that film in January. And you kind of said we can't talk about the film too much, which I agree, because the ending has somewhat of, you can't really talk about the ending. You can't really talk about the whole film, but the ending is what made me want to watch it again. I would gladly sit through this again, knowing how the film ended, because it would be like watching an entirely different movie.
Well, you're absolutely right. It came out in January 15th of 2010, came out on DVD in June. And Oscar voters, make sure you check it out for possible cinematography consideration.
And I know we're talking about a film that's, you know, almost a year old at this point, when we should be talking about this week's films. But
it is an Oscar potential for a tech credit, like you say. And who would be at the Oscars if that movie did get a nomination?
Well, that's what I was going to say. We should be talking about this week's films like Love and Other Drugs, which you called a Jake Gyllenhaal film. And frankly, I look at it as an Anne Hathaway film. And
well, that shows where we're coming from, doesn't it?
Exactly. And I guess on more ways than one. But the reason I say that is because apparently Anne Hathaway is on a lot of people's minds, because the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced on Monday that James Franco from 127 Hours and other films like The First Spider-Man and Anne Hathaway will be co-hosting the 83rd Academy Awards. And their respective ages, they're 32, and that's, I believe, Franco, and Hathaway is 28. The two actors are among the youngest hosts for the award show ever. Both, of course, Hathaway and Franco, are accomplished and well-known and well-respected actors, but their primary job qualification for hosting a live variety show, guess what it is?
What?
Hosting Saturday Night Live.
That's all they can claim for experience, because he doesn't have any live or TV experience like that, nor does she, obviously.
No, but, and remember, last year, the host of the Oscars, there were two hosts, which were Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin. So
and they've both hosted Saturday Night Live like a gazillion times. It was even a joke.
Right, but they're in their 50s. And
right, but that's funny that they're looking to SNL for their hosts of the Oscars.
Well, Don Mischer, the producer of the Oscar telecast, said, it's a little younger in its approach. They are attractive and young. They can be playful at times, and it felt good to us as the direction we wanted to go with the show. I'm hoping he's talking about Hathaway and Franco there, but you can see what they're trying to do. They're trying to bring in a much younger audience.
Right. I'm Bob Hope and Johnny Carson are probably the two most famous Oscar hosts.
What about Billy Crystal?
Well, sure, for modern kids. I go old school. You're right. Those, but they did a lot more than Billy Crystal has so far. But yeah, back in the day, and then certainly in recent years, Billy Crystal, I can't see anybody who comes anywhere near the age of 28.
Well, it will be interesting, especially since both of them, Franco and Hathaway, may be nominated for lead acting awards. I'm not so sure about Hathaway. Franco seems to be a shoo-in, and it wouldn't be the first time that a host has won an Academy Award.
That's true. My best hope for this is that because they are not sketch people and they're not comedy people, that it means that they will be there as hosts and keep the show moving. They'll have a brief opener and then just let them in, you know, keep it going, because they won't feel obliged, I hope, to do, you know, 20 minutes of filler like hosts are so often think they need to do, which is ridiculous because the show is 18 hours long. So the fact that they're young and that they are not comedy people will hopefully keep the Oscars focused on making the show shorter and punchier and keeping it focused on the movies and the performances and not original sketch material that they feel obliged to come up with every year.
Well, there are so many ways to segue into this next story from what you said. One, the film we're about to talk about will not be short. That's for sure. But it will be original. And I'm talking about The Hobbit, which Peter Jackson has now said he will film in 3D. And he's going to use a special camera, which a company called Red has manufactured. And it's called the Epic, which has 5K resolution. Now, film is effectively 6K resolution, but by the time it hits our eyes in the cinema after answer prints and release prints. It's usually around 4K, you know, between 2 and 4K. And the camera could shoot up to 120 frames per second. A lot of people feel, a lot of technology experts and engineers in the motion picture industry feel that 24 frames per second, which is what cameras shoot at and projectors project the film at, they feel that that's too slow and it kind of makes motion a little too blurry. But 120 frames per second, obviously, that's a lot. And
that's a huge jump up.
Yeah, right. So the dynamic range is pretty immense. But so it's official. Peter Jackson will be shooting The Hobbit in 3D.
And now I would like to continue my performance of Karen. Oh, no!
Yes.
She hates 3D.
She hates 3D. I'm a little sad that she's not here to kind of bash this news.
Is the 5K resolution, it shoots in 5K, is it easier for them to maintain that by the time it gets to cinema? Are you implying that it will be degraded down to 3K by the time we see it? Or because of the way it's shot in digital, that it will become stay at 5K?
Well, great question, Michael, and I don't know whether you were setting me up, but of course I happen to work in that particular field, and I can tell you that right now, digital cinema, there are two different resolutions. 2K, which is what the Digital Cinema Initiative's spec requires. You have to have at least 2 million lines of resolution, and so 2K, which is better than HD, or 4K, which is Sony's attempt, and of course now all of the projector manufacturers make a 4K chip. You wouldn't get 5K, you wouldn't get 6K, you wouldn't get 4K. And I can tell you, having sat through experiments, 4K really only affects a certain number of people in the audience that are sitting in very specific places. So most people in the audience would never know and could never tell the difference between a 2K and a 4K image on screen.
How about compared to a film? You say a film comes out at about 3K by the time it reaches you?
No, it's about 4K.
4K. So can you tell the difference between film at 4K and that at 2K?
Good question. And I think sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. It really depends on what you're...
The presentation and where you're seated and all that.
Where you're seated and what they're projecting. I mean, if it's very white, then you might be able to notice it.
Does this make you geek out? Do you feel like one reason he did this was because of the capability of these new cameras? They're much smaller. They have much better resolution. Is this one reason why he might have decided to go 3D, other than the fact that it's the type of film that makes sense in 3D?
Well, I think a part of it is the fact that he has tested the Red One. It's the Red One Epic is the name of the camera, and they are incredibly tiny. I mean, you could fit one in the palm of your... You could hold one camera with both your hands. You don't need a whole crew of people to pick it up and move it. And of course, when you're shooting 3D, you need two of them side by side, and he's going to use 30. So effectively, that's about 15 camera setups. So I think you're right. The technology is there. It looks phenomenal, and he's tested it. And it's incredibly small, so he can move it around without a lot of restraint. Now, it'll be the first film shot with the Red One Epic. And Michael, I happen to know you saw the very first film shot with a Red digital camera.
Did I?
Yes, you did. We saw it together, as a matter of fact, in Cannes.
What was that? Was it the Lord of the Rings?
No, Steven Soderbergh's Che.
Che.
Che, the 9.5-day movie that he made about Che Guevara.
Well, nothing could be less Che Guevara-like than talking about massive multimillion-dollar Hollywood productions.
True, and it looks like Warner Brothers wants to make another massive multimillion-dollar Hollywood production with a film that has already been made.
Tell me.
Well, they want to reboot, because that's the new catchphrase in Hollywood these days, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Good idea or bad idea?
Bizarre idea, since they don't have Joss Whedon involved.
That's the most bizarre idea out of the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great franchise, a very incredibly popular TV series. I mean, I should put it in context, because it was for the WB and CW, and it never had huge numbers, but it obviously ran for 7 years, and I'm sure it's been extremely profitable for them. They've continued to tell stories in comic books and graphic novels and in other areas. Joss Whedon's very, you know, he's a hot button producer. He's the man. So why they wouldn't want to go to him and say, hey, do you want to take this to a movie? How do you feel about this? I don't get it. It's a complicated universe that he's continued to build upon, and they're giving it to somebody I've never heard of.
Joss Whedon was the original writer on the original Buffy movie, and of course, the television series that followed.
Who is Whit Anderson, do you know?
Nobody knows. I know that Joss Whedon made a joke that it's Whit Stillman and Wes Anderson combined, but that's not
all I see is Whit Anderson credited on IMDb is as an actress. but a very small, tiny, tiny, tiny roles in shorts. But who knows? Very strange. But
well, it looks like they're trying to do it for a price, frankly, because
as really?
First off, Joss Whedon's going to cost you a pretty penny because he's, as you said, a well-known writer and producer. And
but why would you try to do a cheap, low-budget version of Buffy? It's if you want to do it, it's a huge potential movie franchise. Why would you want to do it cheaply?
I don't know. I mean, the first film was released by 20th Century Fox.
Right. And it was basically a flop.
Right. And I don't – well, yeah.
But anyway, Joss Whedon reacted to it, and he had a funny quote. He said, "This is a sad, sad reflection on our times when people must feed off the carcasses of beloved stories from their youth just because they can't think of an original idea of their own. Like I did with my new Avengers idea that I made up myself." He's, of course, directing The Avengers, this movie based on the long-running comic book series. Then he later said, "I always hoped that Buffy would live on even after my death. But, you know, after. I don't love the idea of my creation in other hands, but I'm also well aware that many more hands than mine went into making that show what it was. And there's no legal grounds for doing anything other than sign audibly. I can't wish people who are passionate about my little myth ill. I can, however, take this time to announce that I'm making a Batman movie because there's a franchise that truly needs updating."
that's a great email that he sent to E! Online. And I really like Christy Swanson, who played Buffy in the original movie. Her reaction to this, she's really excited and hopes they'll call her to participate because, of course, nobody knows what she's been doing for the last 15 years.
Right. It's just another reboot and remake, but they're not doing it right. I don't understand it. I mean, it's a valuable, valuable property for Warner Brothers. I can see them wanting to make a movie. I can see them approaching him. Did he say no or, you know, I don't get it.
Well, before we leave movie news, we actually have some sad news. Irvin Kershner, a filmmaker, best known probably for The Empire Strikes Back.
And Eye of the Needle, which came out the same summer, which also was a very good movie.
Well, he passed away at the age of 87, and he was a graduate of the USC Film School. And years later, he would teach a young, like-minded student named?
George Lucas.
Yes. But, of course, he, as you mentioned, directed other films. He worked with Roger Corman in 1958 on Stakeout on Dope Street. He worked with Sean Connery then in 1966 on A Fine Madness, which is a film a lot of people don't remember. It wasn't one of Sean Connery's big films. But he worked with Connery again in 1983 on Never Say Never Again, which was an unsanctioned James Bond film. Of course, without a doubt, he will best be known for directing The Empire Strikes Back.
Absolutely. It's the best Star Wars movie of them all. I'm taking the argument now what people make about Star Wars, the original. That's arguable now. I'll go with that. But Empire Strikes Back, unquestionably, easily the most entertaining and memorable Star Wars movie. Why they didn't let him direct more, I'll never know.
Well, and some say it was, up to that point in time, the best sequel ever.
Yes. Well, Godfather Part II had already come out.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But no, it's great. And of course, other sad news, Leslie Nielsen, the actor Leslie Nielsen died. I love him most for the TV series Police Squad, but he had a serious career before he fell into comedies in a way. And then, of course, Airplane and the Naked Gun movies, a very funny, droll comic actor.
Yeah. And Mark Hirsch, writing for National Public Radio, he kind of did a little remembrance and said that he really, out of all of the roles that Leslie Nielsen performed and created, he liked Nielsen in the Saturday Night Live appearance he did in 1989. Yeah. And I like the fact that he said the opening monologue was fantastic. It was probably the most memorable opening monologue he'd ever heard because Nielsen was saying, "I don't know why I'm associated with funny movies. I'm neither a comedian nor a comic." And he said, "A comedian was someone who says funny things. A comic was someone who says things in a funny way." I thought that was a very profound statement.
And he didn't write it.
No, he didn't.
I'm sure he didn't. You know, they're writers.
Oh, okay.
But he is very funny. He was very funny on that show.
Well, since we're talking about television, we may as well move on to television news. And it turns out, as much as everybody was yelling and screaming about Bristol Palin on Dancing with the Stars, turns out she boosted ratings by 23%.
I've had the time of my life. That's what Jennifer Grey was saying because she won, thankfully, over her storybook opponent, Bristol Palin. But Jennifer Grey was the better dancer, and she did win the show. And the finale reached
23.7 million viewers.
That was the final competition. The finale, the results show reached 24.1 million viewers. The show has been averaging about 20 million viewers. American Idol could possibly hold it off if their new judges work. There will certainly be a lot of curiosity. I mean, this is my big question. Idol has been number one 6 years in a row, but Dancing with the Stars has been growing and growing. And this year they caught lightning in a bottle with Bristol Palin, which really helped their bolster up their ratings. So it's going to be neck and neck to see how it works out this year.
Somebody else getting big ratings was Oprah Winfrey. She earned the best rating she's received in the last 3 years.
Well, right. If you watch the show, she's been branding it as Oprah the Farewell Season, which is very smart. The show's been on a gentle but predictable decline over the last 5 or 10 years. It sort of ranks in the middle of syndicated shows right now, nowhere near as big as like The Wheel of Fortune, which it used to trounce and be the number one show in syndication.
Judge Judy was beating her out. I mean, a judge show.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But that's what happens. You're on for 20 years, people take you for granted. But this final season, she's really pulled it out of all the stops. She reunited the cast of The Sound of Music, which may not sound like a big deal. It was the first time the family in the movie, all the actors who played the kids and Maria and obviously Christopher Plummer, were all together since the movie's premiere.
By Maria, you mean Julie Andrews.
Yeah, Julie Andrews, yeah. Despite all the sing-along Sound of Music events and all the anniversaries and all the big events surrounding that movie, they were never all together on one place until Oprah said, come to my show. And she's had other people like the kids of Michael Jackson. She had Marie Osmond talking about her son's suicide. No, he's not gay, says Marie. How would you know is what I say. President George Bush was on there.
George W. Bush, we should say.
George W., yeah. Talking about his book, of course. So she's always had big guests, but she's really, marketing and branding this final season and making it a big deal, and the ratings are showing it.
We talked about Leslie Nielsen hosting Saturday Night Live. There is another wannabe host of Saturday Night Live, much like Betty White went on a campaign. Well, she didn't go on a campaign. The internet went on a campaign for her to host Saturday Night Live, and it was one of the best episodes this season and in a long time. Well, now somebody else wants to host Saturday Night Live, and this person, or this particular character, is actually going out on a campaign. I think this is brilliant.
It's very funny. It's the Cookie Monster from Sesame Street, and the point is whether or not he goes on Saturday Night Live, and he probably will at some point, it brings attention to Sesame Street and it makes him cool. You know, Elmo's been stealing his thunder and now the Cookie Monster wants to get it back. So he's got a Facebook fan page. I think he's Twittering. They do YouTube stuff. I mean, it's very funny, very clever.
Well, here's the YouTube video, actually. I'll just play a portion of it. And he's talking into a camera addressing the audience.
Oh, we got to check focus. Who care about focus? Hello, me, Cookie Monster. Me know many of you think of me as cookie-eating fanatic bordering on glutton. Me prefer the term cookie enthusiast. Yeah, but there are more to me than that. Yeah, and me want to show the world. So, me think that the time to branch out beyond me cookie-eating career. Yeah, me ready for next logical step. Hosting Saturday Night Live.
And he then goes on to kind of do a whole show in 6 minutes, and he throws it over to Cookie Gaga, which I think is a really well-done video, and Sesame Street really knows how to use social media. I wish Karen were here for this, because as a social media maven, she really, I think, would appreciate it.
I wonder if they spoke to Saturday Night Live before they launched it, or whether they just did it and surprised SNL.
I bet you they just did it.
They might have, but they might have said, hey, we're going to do this just to let them know and have them, be prepared with a press release or something, Why not? It's all for fun, so.
Well, in music news, there was really only one story this week. It was all Kanye.
No.
All the time.
No.
Well, okay, you see, that's the kind of arguments that were had all week long.
The biggest music news this week, in a way, symbolically, just because of the ad campaign, was the Beatles coming to iTunes. And I say that because, in fact, when I passed a billboard in Alabama saying the Beatles are now on iTunes, or there was an ad on TV or something, my nephew, who's in college, turned to me and said, hey, did you hear the Beatles have come to iTunes? And he said it very deadpan. It was very funny because, of course, the entire world knew the Beatles had come to iTunes because they'd done such a good job of launching it and making the announcement and all that sort of stuff. So in my mind, even though it's a flash in the pan moment and won't really matter in the scope of things, the big news this week was the Beatles finally caving and coming to digital iTunes.
Well, we talked about that last week, of course. It was just happening when we started recording. But I guess we now have some figures for their first week. They sold 2 million tracks and 450,000 albums digitally.
Yeah. We don't know how many box sets they sold. iTunes has box sets available for $149 of all the remastered CDs. And Amazon retaliated or reacted to that by making the box sets of the remastered CDs available for less money. Which is kind of ironic because we were talking about how ebooks should be less money than a physical book. And Amazon is saying, hey, you were going to buy the Beatles for $150 on iTunes. Why don't you buy it for $130 from us? And you get the actual CDs and the nice booklet. They've also down-priced albums and double CDs. You get regular albums for $8 and you know, things like the White Album for $12.
Well, for $129, yeah. A 16-CD box set, I might get that.
Well, it's great. And, you know, even if you're not a fan, seriously, the mono version is the way to go. It is mind-blowing, and it's the way they meant the music to be heard. So if you buy the mono version, it does not come with the last two albums, Let It Be and Abbey Road. You have to buy those individually because those were not mono albums. But it
in
comes
fact,
with
they
the
were
first...
quadraphonic. At least one of them was quadraphonic.
Oh, sure. They would have been available in that format too, but they were designed to be heard in stereo. They released a quadraphonic version, and earlier albums, they released them in stereo, but they were designed and created to be heard in mono, the first bunch of albums, and the last two in stereo. So go for the mono. It's a different mixes, different sound. Even if you're not that much of a fanatic, it sounds so great and is so cool sounding and really different that buy the mono box and then buy Abbey Road and Let It Be individually, and you'll be very happy.
Well, did you buy Kanye West's new album?
I didn't because I was out of town. I will get a copy of it. I don't have a copy of it yet, but it got rave reviews. I saw Rolling Stone gave it 5 stars. Pitchfork gave it a 10 out of 10. You know, and he, of course, was on Saturday Night Live. You know, before the album came out, he went on SNL and did a really good performance of one of the songs. So he's been everywhere.
Yeah, a song that criticizes Saturday Night Live, I might add.
Yeah, that's right.
He has been promoting it everywhere, and kudos to Lorne Michaels for letting him go on the show and perform a song that, you know, basically was trashing Saturday Night Live. Rolling Stone and Pitchfork, you mentioned, first time ever that they both agree and, or that they both have top ratings for a particular album. Yes.
Where'd you read that?
In a number of places.
I guess Pitchfork doesn't have a long history, so it's not too surprising.
Yeah, and the name of the album, Michael, My Beautiful Dark Twisted...
Fantasy.
My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. And, you know, Kanye was on Twitter. He was hailing the work of renowned artist Mark Rothko as if somehow Rothko needed Kanye West's approval. You could listen to a grandmother read some of Kanye's Twitter posts on YouTube, or you could watch children reenact some of Kanye's Twitter posts, which was very funny. Quincy Jones was saying, hey, I don't care about this Kanye West character. He's just a rapper, and he has nothing on me when it comes to talent. I know how to orchestrate an entire 70-piece orchestra. Can he do that?
He's getting very street, Quincy Jones.
Well, he's getting very street when he comes out of my mouth, apparently. I don't know. I actually, Quincy Jones, great trumpet player. West announced he will release his own cologne as well in 2011, which it'll be sold alongside Jay-Z's iconic fragrances. And the big news was that he performed this last-minute concert at the Bowery Ballroom right there in New York. If you weren't traveling, Michael, you could have gone. Or not really, since concert tickets were almost impossible to get a hold of.
That's right, yeah. The fans went on Twitter to say, why can't I find a ticket to Kanye West? Sort of those, you know, stealth last-minute shows. It's just a clever way to get a little more bump of attention for yourself and your new album.
Yeah, and I love the New York Times posted all of these Twitter comments, usually from, you know, the Village Voice and writers of Spin Magazine and music critics. Chris Weingarten saying, Pearl Jam was right. Oh, no, actually, he didn't say that. That was Steve Candle of Spin Magazine. Rob Harvilla of the Village Voice said, how many anti-Ticketmaster investigative reports are being born at this exact moment?
Why? What? In what sense? What were they upset
about? Well,
they
were all trying to get tickets.
Well, who? I mean, it's like seats like 500 people. I mean, who would expect themselves to be able to get tickets? I don't get it. Even if there were no scalpers in the world, they'd be gone in 2 seconds.
Yeah, well.
I was a little confused by the LA Times story, which I wasn't able to read fully. I always thought of Kanye West as sort of a loose cannon that probably drove his publicist crazy with his comments on Twitter and elsewhere, where he boasts or brags or disses that or that, you know, creates problems for himself. But in fact, I think the LA Times is arguing that he's very savvily keeping himself in the public eye.
Well, they're not only saying that he's very savvily keeping himself in the public eye, they're also saying that it's working. The way he is reaching out to his audience and engaging his audience via Twitter, he is shaping the message. literally. And that's actually the story appeared in the LA Times today, Tuesday. Kanye West shapes the message his way. It was written by Chris Lee and Todd Martins. Todd Martins, of course, has been on the show before. And they write, even in an era where social networking tools allow artists ever greater freedoms to communicate directly with fans, the so-called Louis Vuitton Don has taken the notion of personally generating his own hype to further extremes than just about anyone in popular culture.
Well, if he's so smart, why isn't his image better?
Well, what they're saying is it doesn't matter, that he's kind of shaping the image that he wants anyway.
Well, if he's that in charge of his image, why is it such a negative image? I understand it doesn't matter sales-wise. But you'd think if he was so savvy about promoting himself, he'd be able to do it without making himself look like an egotistical schmuck.
You know what? Let's get him on the phone. We'll find out. I have no idea.
How easy would that be?
I mean, his album apparently has sold 550,000 copies in its first week.
Taylor Swift said, uh-huh.
Yeah, that's right. Taylor Swift said, take that. I sold 1.2 million in my first week.
But how easy would it be to get him in an interview?
Well, actually, yeah. Unsurprisingly, The writers over at the Times tried to get him in an interview for their piece, and they write, efforts to reach West were unsuccessful. When his publicist was asked via email about West's interview availability on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being not a chance and 10 being a sure thing, the publicist responded with a numerical 1, accompanied by a frowny face emoticon.
That's very good. And I'd like to point out that you just did something that I heartily approve of, and that was to not name the publicist. When I read a story in the newspapers or magazines or online, and they say, oh, the publicist for, you know, Denzel Washington, Bob Schmidlmeier, or whatever, they don't need to be named. They are not important. Don't name them. Nobody cares. They don't deserve any attention. They don't need it. It's not their job. I hate it when people quote publicists or name them. You know, there's a few incredibly high-powered ones, and I'm like, I don't ever want to mention any of them. All we care about is the star. So I'm glad that you skipped over that person's name. If they're good at their job, they shouldn't want to be in the newspaper or magazine. So there you go. That's just my little editorial for the day.
Well, Ronnie Chasen, who was murdered just 2 weeks ago, held the same opinion. She never wanted to be out front. She always kind of stayed in the back, and she was considered an old school publicist. A lot of publicists like Ronnie Chasen would agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about album sales, and you could have gotten Kanye West's album for 99 cents if you would have taken the Amazon promotion of $3 off a $3.99 album. You could have gotten his album for 99 cents.
I'm confused. What were they offering?
There was some promotion they were running, $3 off of their MP3 store.
And they were selling the digital download version of the album for
$4? $4.99 or something like that, yeah.
Just like they did with the Taylor Swift album.
Right, and they're doing it with the Rihanna album. In fact, Groupon is kicking off the holiday season today with its Grouponicious deals.
Excuse me, what's Groupon?
Okay, glad you asked. Groupon is a discounting website where if enough people go and say, yes, I'm interested in paying $20 for a $35 meal at Red Lobster, then you will be able to print out a coupon and go to Red Lobster and use that coupon to pay for your meal. Of course, you have already paid at that point because you would have paid Groupon. So in this case, Amazon and Groupon, I guess, are teaming up and they're offering Rihanna's fifth studio album, Loud, for, I guess, $3.99. Actually, no, Amazon and Groupon are not teaming up. Amazon just lowered their price to meet Groupon's price.
Oh, I see. So Groupon is, and Groupon, have they been doing DVDs and CDs and stuff like this for a while, or is this new for them, or what's the deal?
No, it's usually clothing or travel or restaurants, and you know what they're saying is it's a very well-known site within the United States, and it could potentially be a massive distribution channel for artists like Rihanna. And, you know, $5 for a digital download, it's like knocking 50% off the normal price.
Well, and right now, the Kanye West album on Amazon is $5 for the MP3 version, for the digital download version. So if you buy the physical CD on sale, it costs $12. If you get the digital download, it's $5. This is, frankly, a really big story that I don't think has been covered very well. They are the number two record store in the country.
Amazon?
One of the biggest in the world. iTunes is number one. Amazon is number two. They've been trying to fight back against iTunes. Music companies were so angry at iTunes. Oh my God, they forced us to sell albums at $10. We need a competitor. And they've been bending over backwards to help Amazon. And now Amazon is selling every hot new album for $5. Way to go, guys. Smart thinking. Finally, you've got somebody who's willing to pay half the price of iTunes for I mean, it's not a loss leader for Amazon because it doesn't, I don't know if they think bringing people to their site helps them to buy other stuff. I assume it's not like a Walmart, Kmart, Best Buy thing where they want to bring you into the store, get you to buy an album at a loss, and then they sell you a refrigerator. I don't think
believe
that's
it or not,
that
is not true at all. They most certainly use deals like this as loss leaders because I guarantee
Amazon
you,
does?
Yes. I guarantee you that the labels have turned to them and said, yeah, you can sell the new Rihanna album or the new Kanye West album for $5. However, we will get $8 or $9 for every album you sell. Whether you charge $5 or $20, we want $9.
I don't know whether they made a deal or whether Amazon's taking a loss every step of the way.
Well, they may but be boy. Taking a loss because they're saying, well, as long as I'm buying the Kanye album, I may as well buy insert name of product here.
And if you go to iTunes right now, the Kanye West album costs $15 for a digital download.
$15 for a digital download is absurd.
Right. So you're saying, gee, do I go to iTunes and buy it for $15? Or do I buy the physical CD for $12? Or do I go to Amazon's digital and get it for $5? It's three times the price. But the record stores are already out of business. So who is Amazon doing this to? iTunes.
iTunes. Absolutely.
Yeah. So they're not trying to take off a mom and pop store. They're trying to get audience and traffic to get used to buying music at Amazon. And it's working because I'm about to buy the album for $5 from Amazon. Instead of getting a CD... Baby, I'm going for the $5. I'll do it during the show.
The album is supposed. Oh, great! So now you're like multitasking during the great.
Sorry about that.
Well, let me ask you this: you were traveling over the weekend for Thanksgiving. If you had been in town, would you have been at Spider-Man: Turn Off the Dark?
No, I would. I would not have been because I want to see it. I want to get free tickets and see it right before it opens and review it for Huffington Post or if I'm lucky, the LA Times. I want to review it for someone and get free tickets. And I don't want to see it. Some people like to go to the first preview of a show. They like to go to that very first performance and be able to tell people and post online and tell people, "Oh my God, it looks like it's going to be a disaster. It looks like it's going to be great." They love to be there first. And there's a whole cult of people who like to go to the very first performance of a show. But of course, they're working out the kinks. And this one made news because it's such a high profile show.
I was going to say some of those people this time included the New York Times.
It's been such a delay in weeks. Everybody wants to know what the heck's going on. How is it? What's happening? And of course, there were incredibly long delays. They had technical issues up the wazoo. They had to stop in mid-performance sometimes. The intermission was like 40 minutes rather than 15 or whatever it was. People got a little antsy. They, in fact, started doing that group applause thing where everybody applauds at the same time. And the guy, this house manager finally came on and said, "Hey, thank you. I understand. You know, you're all here." Some woman got up during the intermission and said, "I don't know how all you feel, but I'm starting to feel like a guinea pig," you know, to try and diss the show. But instead of getting applause from the audience, she just got booed. And I think that's not so much a reflection of the show's quality, but just, hey, they wanted to be there first. They knew what they were doing. They knew it had been delayed. So, you know, hey, accept it, sister. So it got tons of attention for the show. And you know what? It's all technical stuff. And while the early comments about the music and the show itself were not overwhelmingly good by any stretch of the imagination, people did say it was a spectacle and that some of that stuff was amazing.
The flying sequences do look amazing. I mean,
yeah, and they've got weeks to work it out, so we'll see what happens.
I mean, it stopped five times in the first act alone, and then they just finally ended that first act prematurely with one of the cast dangling 10 feet above the audience. I thought that was
right.
Kind of funny.
But all that matters is, you know, what happens at the end.
Right.
And what happens when it opens.
That's absolutely right. It's $65 million. It's the most expensive Broadway musical, most expensive Broadway show of all time, twice that of Shrek. And
even adjusted for inflation, I think it's probably the most expensive show of all time.
Right. And if you look at it, while the preview was going on, they were being featured on 60 Minutes. Did you see any of that?
I was traveling. I didn't see it. I heard other people calling and texting me about the 60 Minutes thing. It apparently was recorded quite a while ago, and it was either an update. Maybe they had run this earlier, but it's the fall, so it should be a new thing. No, it was during Thanksgiving. I'll bet it was a rerun.
No, it was a new story that they had been working on for a year and a half. They had hoped to have it on when the show was...
But the interviews looked like they were done a long time ago, is what I'm saying.
They were. Some of them were done a long time ago, and they're done sporadically throughout the year and a half.
Yeah, so they had interviews that were kind of outdated, but they had, you know, behind the scenes footage and all that stuff. it's going to be a disaster.
They had footage of the last dress rehearsal, so I don't know why.
No, the footage was recent and it looked great, but they had interviews from like 6 months ago. You have Bono talking about the show 6 months ago. Well, good God, that's like talking about a movie I'll make 2 years from now.
You know, the best part of the whole 60 Minutes show for me was when Bono got up to join the cast and he was playing Peter Parker. I guess Peter Parker wasn't there. And the difference in the voices. I mean, that guy is such a rock star. I mean, he gets up and he shows him how it's done.
Exactly.
And it's just without any warning. And it really, you can kind of sense, wow, okay, so that's how you do it.
So if Spider-Man gets in trouble, hey, why not put Bono in the role of Peter Parker? See what happens.
Yeah, put him on some wires and throw him around the auditorium.
If things are looking rough, it's just an idea.
How about rock stars at royal weddings?
Are you segueing to Big Deal, Big Whoop?
Indeed, I am segueing to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or a big whoop. Our first story is about Elton John. Will the Rocket Man be at the royal wedding? Elton John was a friend of Diana, Princess of Wales, and famously performed at her funeral. Now Diana's son, Prince William, might very well be asking Elton John to perform at the royal wedding in April. John offhandedly told BBC Radio he would probably perform and then downplayed his revelation by joking that he'd be busking outside of Westminster Abbey to make a few bucks from the throngs that will be gathered there. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And I would throw it over to Karen, but she's not here. So, Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Karen would say it's a big whoop. Guy gets gig working at wedding. I'll say it's a big whoop. It's a nice touch. But, you know, Prince William has shown a willingness to embrace his mother's legacy in a way that's very nice and touching and well thought out. And so having Elton John perform at his wedding, when it meant a lot to the kids that he was at the funeral, actually, the Queen Mother and the other royals were like, what? You want a pop guy to perform at the funeral and sing a song? They were kind of aghast. It was the rumors backstage. But the kids and the younger generation prevailed, and Elton John performed at the funeral, which is a little unusual. You don't often have a pop star there to sing a song.
You don't often have a backstage at a funeral either.
And he did, and it was really an emotional highlight of the funeral. It was incredibly touching, and in fact, the people thronging outside the funeral burst into applause, and you could, inside the theater, he finished and was very quiet, and you could hear the applause sort of sweep in from outside from all the thousands of people or tens of thousands who were out there at the end of that song, and it was really touching, and I bet it meant a lot to the kids, and so to have him be there at a happy moment where his mom can't be, obviously, will be a nice touch.
You know, this next story, Michael, I know you're going to hate because,
yes.
And I, whoever showed my kids the flash mob on Oprah of the Black Eyed Peas.
Oh, yeah.
I just could kill them because now my kids run around singing.
Tonight's going to be a good night.
That's right.
Tonight's going to be a good, good night.
That's right. They love that song. And the Super Bowl halftime show in February will be a good, good time if the Black Eyed Peas have anything to say about it. 7 years after Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction, and I say that with air quotes, the Super Bowl is tentatively dipping its toe back into contemporary pop with the top-selling band after playing it safe with icons like the Rolling Stones, The Who, and Bruce Springsteen. Is the Black Eyed Peas playing the Super Bowl halftime show a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I say it's a big deal because you had those iconic people. But as far as acts that are really at their peak of popularity, the last time they did it was U2 in 2002. And that was to follow up the 9/11 victims. It was one of the most touching moments of touching isn't the word you would use for a halftime show. It's one of the most memorable moments of a Super Bowl halftime ever, perhaps the top moment ever. But really, you'd have to go back to Michael Jackson, which really started off this whole trend of really, really big acts doing the halftime show. And he was kind of a little bit past his peak, but still obviously a world icon. But Black Eyed Peas are huge. Their last album was a massive worldwide hit. So they're really hotter than ever. So this is a big deal.
Drats foiled again. Has Batman's arch nemesis, the Joker, made it a mission to thwart comic book fans? They were frustrated, to say the least, when tickets for the 2011 Comic-Con in San Diego went on sale and the site crashed. Overwhelming popularity or technical incompetence? A little of both, but more of the latter, especially since the sale date had been rescheduled after they went on sale a month ago and the site crashed that time, too. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal as far as the intense desire to attend Comic-Con. I think they had like 120,000, 130,000 people there last year. But it should also be a big deal for whoever gets fired, because somebody should be.
Well, I think the big deal is that Comic-Con is becoming increasingly overcrowded.
Well, that's true, but that's a different. You're right. They it's too big. It's too popular. But I don't know exactly how they could deal with that. They just have to limit the tickets they sell.
Well, here's somebody who is limiting the number of tickets they sold.
Tickets, oh, don't. Yeah.
Thanks for playing, Brendan Fraser. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. That's how the actor might feel after making his Broadway debut in the comedy Elling, only to see the show close after only 9 performances. Another early shuttering is the final musical collaboration by Kandor and Ebb, called the Scottsboro Boys. That highly touted entry closes on December 12th. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's not Brendan Fraser's fault, so it's not on his shoulders. He didn't get bad reviews personally. He was fine. I saw the show. It's called Elling. It's actually a small little comedy. I saw it in London in a space that would probably fit on the stage of where they performed this show, including the audience. I mean, the show and the entire audience could fit on the stage where this Elling was portrayed. It was the wrong space for the show. It should have been a tiny off-Broadway show. That just doesn't work economically anymore for many reasons. It's too bad. It's a good show, and it was just the wrong space, the wrong production design, the wrong look. It looked like an Ibsen play. It was so stark and naked on the stage, and it's this small little comedy, and it was just everything was wrong about it. But it wasn't his fault, and he was actually fine. And Scottsboro Boys, that is the real scandal. That is a great show. I joked when I reviewed it. I said, you know, these are the guys behind Chicago and Cabaret. And when I reviewed this new show, which is sensational, I joked and said, you know, it's going to close in 6 months and then reopen 20 years later and be raved and be a massive success. And in fact, it's closing in about 6 weeks.
So then maybe it will open in 10 years.
Exactly.
Is Jeremy Renner the new Tom Cruise? He's filming Mission Impossible 4 right now. And the star of the Oscar-winning film The Hurt Locker told MTV News that, yes, there was a possibility he'd take the franchise forward down the road. Though Renner emphasized it was Cruise's baby and it's up to him. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for Jeremy Renner, who is this minor actor a year ago or 2 years ago, and now he's in Mission Impossible 4. He's the second lead with Tom Cruise. He plays Hawkeye. Is that the name of the character in The Avengers, that big movie that Joss Whedon is promoting? He plays one of the superheroes in that. I never pictured him as an action franchise hero, but good luck for him. But the funny thing is, it's sort of like Tom Cruise is aging into the mentor role. You know, he's handing off Mission Impossible, perhaps, to Jeremy Renner. He's going to appear in a Top Gun sequel, and I assume he'll be an instructor, handing it off to some young maverick just like him. I mean, that's what I'm fantasizing about. That's what I think will happen. Tom Cruise becoming the grand old man of movies.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Pulp Fiction and Clerks. Coming to YouTube? That could happen. The new owners of the Miramax Library are apparently in talks with Google about making movies from their 700-film library available via YouTube to generate a little of the old cash. DVDs are so 20th century. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It seems like a minor revenue stream to me, getting them on YouTube and people being able to watch them that way via ads or pay for them. I'm not sure what the idea is. Do you know?
I have no clue. Let me call Eric Schmidt over at Google and find out about their super secret negotiations.
And we'll get right back to you.
Yeah.
But hey, any revenue stream that there is, any way of making movies available, why not?
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we discuss only the news stories that Hollywood might care about. And Michael, for several weeks now, you have been putting in fair use stories into this segment, and we've been skipping right over them. So why don't you fill us in on some of the stories that you've highlighted for us?
Well, there are a bunch of different stories. They're vaguely related to the idea of fair use, which is what is fair for somebody else to use. Like if you're quoting a book, can you quote a paragraph from that book in your newspaper story or your article or your thing? Yes, you can. A paragraph out of a 200, 300 page book, that's fine. Can you play 10 seconds of a song, a 3 minute song? What about 20 seconds? What about 40 seconds? So it's an issue that always comes up. And in our country, we go too far overboard in copyright protection. But our laws are weighted strongly towards the owners of the stuff rather than saying, hey, we want them to make money, but then this stuff becomes common property. You know, the music and art and film and books and everything ultimately belongs to everybody, you know, 50 years after they're created or whatever.
Well, think about it. Disney, because of Mickey Mouse, got copyright increased to 70 years.
which is insane, 70 years after the creator's death. And they keep, well, they keep expanding. It's called the Mickey Mouse Law because it was 20 years or 25 years. Then Disney got them to push it to 50, and now it's 70 years. And nobody else in the world has laws that last that long. That's why things can be public domain in Europe, why you can get box sets of certain CDs or old Laurel and Hardy shorts. Why they don't come out in the U.S., I don't know, but they're on DVD in a box set in England. And I want artists to make money, and I think their estates should be able to make money. But at some point, they have to become available to the public. That's also different from the fair use right the day it comes out. Kanye West has a new album out. Can I play 10 seconds on my radio show? Yes. Can I sample a section of it that's very distinctive and put it in my pop song? No, I can't.
So no, because you would be benefiting financially from the latter.
Well, you benefit financially earlier, you know, but they consider it fair use to talk about his new album and play a 10 seconds of it on air. That's not considered unfair use, even though my show will sell advertising and perhaps benefit from it financially and from the fact that I'm able to talk about his album, but that's considered fair use.
So now what brought this news story up? I mean, what is it, this topic?
All sorts of them. I mean, and VCRs and DVRs and all these things bring up fair use questions. And so all these stories deal with this. The first one is about The Tonight Show. The Tonight Show with Jay Leno did a montage of Taylor Swift winning awards and looking surprised. It was a funny little clip job. They hadn't created it. They found this clip job done online by bloggers who had obviously pulled footage from the Grammy Awards and the Country Music Association Awards. So they'd taken clips from those shows and cut them together in a fair use way and posted them online. The Tonight Show found this montage, thought it was clever, and contacted them, to their credit, and said, hey, we want to use this on their show. And I don't know whether they paid the money or just got permission or what, but they spoke to them and wanted to use it. And so then they used it on the show, but they didn't credit the bloggers. You know, they used it, and they never said, oh, by the way, this isn't us, this is them. It was slightly different, but it was clearly inspired, and the guys had done all the work, basically, the bloggers. It could be men or women, I don't know. But those guys had done the work. Tonight Show called them. And then they didn't post any notice about where it came from. So that created an online uproar. And the guy who did it said, hey, one of the guys said, hey, it's good for us, actually, because we got more attention because they failed to credit us than we would have anyway. So the next night, the Tonight Show at the very end threw on a credit saying, this was done by these guys. Just to give them some credit. It wasn't as graceful as they should have done. Jay Leno should have said, hey, last night we showed this funny thing. It came from these guys, blog online. Go to their website. You know, why not?
Yeah, but I was really surprised. They just kind of like flashed something on the screen. It was kind of lame.
It was very lame. So it was pathetic. So it's funny. These guys did fair use by pulling clips from different award shows. The Tonight Show did the right thing by contacting them and saying, hey, we're going to use this. We want to use this. You know, they're going to use the whole thing. So
but there was also this issue with South Park.
Yes. Well, South Park is fascinating. Now, South Park got in trouble a while ago because they were looking for dialogue from the movie Inception, and they ended up finding this spoof of Inception, and they quoted lines that they thought were from the movie, and they used some comic ideas from this website, but they mostly thought they were getting lines from the film, which was not in their theaters near them, and they didn't have a DVD, obviously. And so they went to this spoof online to pull dialogue from the film, but it turned out they were pulling fake dialogue that the guys had created for this spoof online. And when the spoof ran on South Park, people thought it was too similar to what the guys had done online, and they got in trouble for it, and they apologized to them and said, we're really sorry, and explained what happened.
And all of this leads to what's happening over the last week or so, with Homeland Security seizing internet domains from what they are claiming is our copyright infringing torrent sites.
How is this in the domain of Homeland Security?
You know, it's funny you should mention that. Everybody, all of the tech blogs and podcasts and, you know, in the tech world, people are just shaking their head going, does Homeland Security and ICE, which is the customs group, how are they involved in this at all?
I mean, it could be, I don't know who it should be, the FCC or I don't know who it should be, but it just doesn't seem like that's the right department.
Well, right now, Congress in the United States is trying to pass COICA, and that is
excuse me.
Yeah, it's a horrible acronym for Combating Online Infringements and Copyrights Act. And what this would do was would allow a government agency, a U.S. government agency, to go in and grab the domain from things like I don't know, Torrents Are Us or whatever the torrent website is.
And it's an incredibly stupidly written law. It's incredibly broad. And it basically says if you just reference another site that includes infringing material, they can grab your site. So like
Google.
Yeah, if I wrote a thing saying how stupid this was that this horrible pirate site existed and mentioned it, they could grab my site. It's just ridiculous.
Right. And so this has been going on. They grabbed 12 domains and shut them down, apparently 70 sites in all. And the same thing last week, a Swedish court kind of upheld the sentencing of, not the sentencing, but the convictions for three Pirate Bay offenders. So last year in 2009, they were convicted and they were sentenced to jail and paying something like $3 million. Well, now
$6 million US, yeah.
Well, now it's been raised to $6.5 million US, 46 million kroner. And I guess they're going to spend less time in jail.
Well, how is the site still active if they've been convicted and all this is going on?
Well, because it runs itself effectively.
Oh, okay. Because of the way it's structured, it's people to people. It's not them involved.
Yeah, you just post stuff there.
So how is this conviction going to help prevent this? Not that I don't think it wasn't designed for illegal use and that they don't necessarily, not that I disagree with their sentencing, but how is this going to help prevent, how are they going to be able to stop Pirate Bay?
You know, if I could answer that question.
You'd be a rich man.
I'd be a rich man and the record industry and the movie industry and the TV folks would be knocking on my door asking me to work for them to prevent piracy.
Awfully complicated. It's a very, as you can see from these four cases, it's endlessly convoluted, but it's kind of fascinating. And I always want to encourage liberal fair use for creative works and other things. And you want to be less liberal when it comes to somebody just slapping together something to try and make a buck.
Well, speaking about copyright and fair use, we have a listener email here from Stephanie. It kind of talks about copyright. Actually, it does. Karen, Michael, and Sperling. On episode 79, you discussed a news story during Big Deal or Big Whoop about how Gene Simmons of Kiss was threatening the hackers who took down his website. I agree with Michael that those who perform such acts deserve to be punished. And that includes Kiss. The news story you linked to is actually about how YouTube took down videos from Kiss's channel over copyright violations. Ironic, given Simpson's own stance on the matter just a few weeks earlier. Still, I love your show. Keep it up. Yours truly, Stephanie.
Well, thanks for writing, Stephanie. She's absolutely right. As I say, sometimes we try to keep the show a little loose and not read too much about stuff so that we can react in the moment, especially for Big Deal, Big Whoop. And in this case, I totally missed the boat on what was ironic about the news story was the fact that Gene Simmons, who'd yelled at other people for attacking his website, was using stuff unfairly on their YouTube channel, I guess it was. But perhaps he would agree with it and he didn't know about it. But this involves from a battle between him and the people who own some of the rights to the videos that he has. So it's a contractual legal thing between him and the other people. He would say, it's my own stuff. How can I not have the right to use it? But when you sign it away, you don't. But thank you for pointing that out because we did miss the boat on that one. And then our next email comes from Peter in San Francisco. He says, hey, kids. I like that. I was listening to episode 80 in which you interviewed Don Chiamaleschi from the LA Times about Disney not doing any more animated films that use fairy tales as source material. However, Ed Catmull, one of the heads of Disney Animation, posted a rebuttal to the Times story via Facebook. He said, quote, a headline in today's LA Times erroneously reported that the Disney fairy tale is a thing of the past. But I feel it is important to set the record straight that they are alive and well at Disney and continue this week with Tangled, a contemporary retelling of a much-loved story. We have a number of projects in development with new twists that audiences will be able to enjoy for many years to come, end quote. Just thought you might want to let listeners know, even though this reads like a non-denial denial. Love the show. Peter, the San Francisco showbiz fan. P.S. Can you guys post the podcast at a specific time each week? Not complaining. It just seems as if they get posted rather randomly. And do you have any plans for a video version? And Peter, if you could see me, you wouldn't ask that question.
he's got the voice for radio and the face for radio, too. No.
This is a great email.
Yeah, it's a great email. And so thank you, Peter. And thanks for pointing that out. I had seen that a little later on in the week.
We would have brought back that update, hopefully, but we let you do it. I didn't mention it earlier, but we appreciate that. It is more stronger than a non-denial, I think. He's saying we got stuff in development, not that we know any names or whatever. It'd be stronger if he could say, hey, we're adapting the sea otter, that beloved fairy tale, or whatever it might be.
Well, and to answer the last two questions, I'll take the video first. We have talked about it. Technically, we are still bouncing around a few ideas. stay tuned. As for when we post the and record, frankly, the podcast each week, it depends on a couple of things. This week it was travel schedules, and nothing we did could work out Karen's travel schedule, so she's not joining us. In some weeks, it's guest availability when they're available. So that's really part of it. And because we're all working professionals, sometimes we'll record the show on a Monday and it takes a little while to post because we like to edit it and, you know, make sure the sound is okay.
But we are, you know, we're trying to take the show to the next stage and interest satellite radio or some radio stations in the areas. We feel like we're ready to grow and move on that. And if we can do that, then maybe we might get paid a little bit more to do the show, and then we'll be on a more consistent professional schedule. So if you know any place that you think should be playing us, let us know.
Yes, we'll be happy to contact them. And in fact, you can get in touch with us by emailing at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail, which we very well may play in future episodes. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, that contact information, as well as links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode, as well as links to all of our past episodes, and links to all of our social networking accounts like Twitter and Facebook, all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT.com, used in a fair use way. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com, or on MySpace. And that, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is what we call attribution. Michael Giltz can be found online as well. His website is michaelgiltz.com, and on Twitter he is at Michael Giltz. Karen Woodward, who usually joins us each week.
Come back.
Well, she can be found on Twitter at Karen_Woodward is the username to look up, or her website, karenwoodwardonline.com. Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com, or I can be found on Twitter at @Sperling is the username to look up. Until next week, play nice.